This conversation was organized by the Center for Human Rights Research at the University of Manitoba. We are located near the Red River in the territories of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Anishinaabe, Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota peoples, and on the national homeland of the Red River Métis. These are lands marked by promises most unfulfilled in Treaty 1 and the Manitoba Act. We get our drinking water from Treaty 3 to the east, and our hydroelectric power from territories to the north and west, particularly in Treaty 5. It is amid these relations and histories that we do the work we do today, which is having a conversation about what it means to learn, teach, and research Canadian history in light of ongoing histories of colonialism. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second episode of the History in the Hot Seat, the Teaching and Knowing of Canada's Past project. I am Hannah Bolek, an undergraduate history student at the University of Manitoba and a research assistant at the Center for Human Rights Research. Today, I will interview Métis educator Kim Dudick about teaching history to middle and secondary year students in Manitoba following the Idle No More movement and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. Kim Dudick is a Métis educator and vice principal at John Pritchard School in Winnipeg. Kim has taught social studies and theater for almost 30 years and has taught grades 5 to 12. She headed the Indigenous Academic Achievement Program, Ethics Bowl Team, Black History Month Committee, and the International Students Program at Murdoch MacKay Collegiate. She was a recipient of the 2021 Manitoba Excellence in Education Award from Manitoba Education and Training. She was also the recipient of the 2023 Bank of Canada's Award for Excellence in Teaching Economics. And she was my drama and global issues teacher at Murdoch MacKay, and she is one of the reasons I chose to study history here at the University of Manitoba. To begin, can you describe your current approach to teaching social studies and how it has changed over time?
For sure. My current approach to teaching social studies is through the lens of an administrator now. So that means engaging with kids in the hallways, popping in on social studies classes and having conversation with whatever topic is being discussed within that class, and then seeing if I can carry that conversation with kids afterwards. This is a radical change for me from the teacher to this now. Because the administrative role is different. You are a teacher leader, so you're still teaching, but it's generally with other teachers. But, I mean, the heart of this is kids. This has changed radically from when I started, and I was probably what would be initially for about a year until I really got my bearings in who I was as a professional and as a educator. I was definitely I speak, you listen person, because that's the way I was taught, right? And that was really uncomfortable. And so, no, that ended probably within, I'll be generous, probably within 3 or 4 years of my teaching style was initially that, and then moved away to conversation with kids and where they're at and what they know and what they're interested in, and for things like project-based learning and interactive work and studies that way. So that for me is a far better method. So.
Yeah. Can you kind of elaborate on non-traditional teaching and learning methods you've used in your classroom?
Absolutely. I love to. Field trips are my favorite. Like, and as you know, right? Let's go. And even if it's just a walk outside, because you have to go outside. You have to. It's land-based learning. You have to take kids, you students, out into the place, and hopefully there are people that remember how the place was used. You like Murdoch, if you look at a lot of our history for that school and Transcona in general, it's like it was developed in, I think it was 1909, and prior to that it was just this empty barren spot, and it was like, nope. Sort of thing. You need to go talk to or find people who can talk to or speak to the area, right? A little ways away was the Seven Oaks Battle. Like, there are things that mm-hmm. happened here, and there are people that know those things. You have to go seek that out. And for me, that's a non-traditional way, is going out onto the land, or going, even if you're an urban kid or urban area, well, it began somewhere, right? To go and see where you can look at how that history came about or came to be. I love guest speakers because I love learning too. So it's like, you know more about this than I do. You come to talk to me, you know, you talk to my kids. Like, what can we learn together and from you, or where are opportunities that all of our knowledge, collective knowledge and individual knowledge, can grow? I love Socratic method, which to me is just a formulated circle, like a circle sit, because I love that one the most, where everybody sits in circle and we talk about something or we bring something to the table, and everybody has to go and back and sort of do their own learning and then come with that knowledge to add to the collective base, right? And then we get to have conflict and discuss, and sometimes very richly, sometimes very shallowly, sometimes deeply. It's students, right? So depending on where they're at or what they know, and they know a lot. I'll never forget one, not just one, but one in particular moment where I had a science teacher come into my room and go, "What were you talking about?" Because they're still talking about this conversation about, whatever was discussed in class. And I was really proud of that my kids felt passionate enough to keep that conversation going. And unfortunately, our system is still very artificial in terms of timeline, or like, if they're that passionate, I should have been able to hold them for a double period, or, you know, stuff like that. The time is this very interesting construct, and how we use it within educating and educating our young ones, if they're passionate about it, we should be allowed to, I don't know, bend time a little bit or not. But the cookie cutter dictates that we do it in certain ways, and for a variety of reasons. It's a systems issue, because then inequities could arise with that too, right? So I get those pieces. But I think there's a better balance somewhere in there.
Yeah. So. I remember you always prioritized us doing projects that really were related to our interests. Mm-hmm. In one of my most fond memories from high school was in your global issues class. Mm-hmm. And me and my two friends who were also in the class got to write a musical about social justice. and that was just, it allowed us to learn so much more because we were doing it in this kind of unconventional way, and we were all very into theater and music, so it played to our interest perfectly. Yeah. I always appreciated your kind of non-traditional approaches.
Yeah, and I appreciate that too, right? And I still have that play. Yeah. I show kids, like, this is what you can aspire to, right? But to also think differently. Like, take a topic and think about it. Look at it upside down. And I mean quite literally. Get up on a table, turn yourself around, and look at something, right? Because it does something with your brain. And then, of course, metaphorically and figuratively, like, whatever the question is, or whatever it is that we're looking at, what are ways to look at it? Look at it narrowly, look at it widely. Anyway, so yeah, conversation, projects, all those pieces that are student-centric, and getting to know students.
I'm curious about the relationship between the curriculum and what teachers actually teach. To what extent is the curriculum kind of voluntary or mandatory in Manitoba, and what is the oversight like?
Your curriculum is your backbone. Like, you have to know your curriculum, and it's not voluntary. It's mandatory. The luxury I have, especially when I was teaching you, I was later in my career. I had gone through my curriculum, you know, a gazillion times. So I understood, even when they manifested change throughout it a little bit, I understood the overarching goal or the overarching piece that that the province wants for their students, their citizens, in social studies history in Manitoba. So that privileges me in a lot of ways that a new teacher just stepping out. Like, again, if I look at myself, if I rated myself as a teacher, I think I was a good teacher. If I look back at my first few years, I was a terrible teacher. Like, I was, you know, like, I was at the new, why is everybody moving? You know, like because it's a control piece, right? And you need to get out your head out of that. And I didn't know my curriculum as well, because I'm young, because I need to learn those things, right? alongside initially, and then not to get arrogant or egotistical that I know everything about my curriculum. No, I don't. How, and of all subjects like history, how could I dare to presume to know everything? Come on. You know, or that it's got to be this way, mandated this way and this way. And dates and things are phenomenal, but we now have, Dudek holds up technology, right? If you have technology in your hand, what you need to know is the veracity of it. Is it true? What is it? Like, are you sure? Like, how do you know? Have you researched? How do we? So the skill set that goes around those pieces. So curriculum is not an option. And it's actually a beautiful thing. Once you know what it is, it's such a guide, it's such a support. How you manifest that curriculum, especially social studies, affords you so many opportunities to do so many cool things. Mm-hmm. That's why I love history. I love the topic. I love the different aspects, the different perspectives. Like you asking, you know, First Nations person, you ask a new immigrant, what does Canada mean? You're going to get very radically different. But that's like in today, if you ask them 200 years ago, I wonder how much would be the same and how much would be different, right? So those perceptions, those stories, phenomenal. Your curriculum, Manitoba, I think, does a fairly good job of trying to instill an overall understanding of this place and the education system in general. And they're changing right now, too, right? It's like they're moving towards a more, I hate this word and I often argue, but standard. But it's a standard way of looking at curriculum in general. So the math curriculum looks like the history curriculum so that I could go in and go, oh, these are the pieces that make sense for the math world for a student to, when they leave grade 12, public education, they're going to know, or private, they're going to know this, or they should have, not know, but they have an understanding or an overall understanding of these pieces. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, your curriculum is important.
Yeah. You've touched a bit on this, but can you elaborate maybe on the specific improvements that have been made to the Manitoba social studies curriculum to acknowledge the Canadian state's dispossession, repression, and exploitation of Indigenous peoples?
Again, this becomes personal, right? Like, mm-hmm. I look back at my own education and wherein I think it was in grade 2, you learned about... and at the time, and you know, forgive my speaking here, you learned about Indians, and it wasn't even discussed that this was a misnamed group of people, right? It just, this is what, you know, my textbooks, and I have those textbooks, actually. I keep a copy to show kids how language is power and how it changes and what that power means. And like the stuff that I was taught, just mind blowing. And it was, you know, in terms of now looking back, what? Like, what? You know, oh, they were hunters and they were gatherers and they fought amongst each other. But there was no story. There was no discussion about values. There was no discussion about child rearing or things that are integral or important, politics, it was so superficial, and it was this like checkbox piece, right? And then from time that I recall, you know, the Métis people, especially as this hits home, they're traitors. Louis Riel was a traitor. And then sometimes to this day, there that question still, is he a traitor to Canada? Dude, Canada wasn't a thing. Like, it was like, are you kidding me? No. But that's the piece that I grew up with. And I watch, you know, I can still remember looking at students, First Nations students or Métis students, and them sort of hiding. Or one student in particular, I remember, you know, arguing with the teacher, but going nowhere because it was the teacher. And back in the day, that was, you know, that was the end, finite, or the principal, if you argued enough kind of thing. But you weren't going to win that battle individually. I always thought about that person and how she stood up to a false narrative, essentially. So things have... So when I go from that to, is it perfect today? Heck no. Like, no. But I think we're making progress. I have, you know, students who understand what the Indian Act means, what Royal Proclamation means, what the Idle No More movement means. If this was in 2024, right? In 2015, that was a year that Murdoch actually was one of the first schools to offer First Nations, Métis, and Inuit studies, right? And the course itself is, as everything, is evolving and changing. And so the Manitoba curriculum and social studies in particular is also evolving slowly. It's like justice to me. You move slowly because you want to try to get it right. But is it just in the meantime? No! And it's maddening. And it's, right, you want to try to get it right as much as possible. Especially with, given to me, the horrific history that we have with this place and the way it was possessed and taken over. There is more of an acknowledgement now. And initially we had 16 students, and some students were Indigenous, some students were not, and one student was New Canadian. And it was interesting how, when I look back at that group of kids, and I'm in contact with a number of them, and the impact that it made, and the way, you know, when I myself, because I was teaching something new, I had to go seek out information. I had to go seek from others how, like, what, okay, so you've given me this textbook essentially to look at, to examine, and some resources. I need to talk to people, right? I need to kind of know perspectives or dynamics or the intangibles, and is there a better way every year? Is there a better way that I can teach this? Is there a better way that I can do this? And I would argue, like, that my last year teaching at 2023, those kids were so tight, right? I had the world. I had Indigenous students who truly understood who, like, they're coming with their voice and agency and who they are and why their history matters and what and educating others. 2015 was vastly different. It was really quiet about that kind of thing, because, and I don't blame people, it was a lot of distrust. And of course, students who did not know their own history. The Manitoba curriculum, to back to your original, has been shifting and considering more deeply its the actual history of what this place means, mm-hmm. and the consequences and the actions that come from decisions from history and what we now work with, right, in our present day.
Mm-hmm. You spoke a bit about gathering resources when you were first kind of figuring out the mm-hmm. curriculum. Do you find that current social studies teachers have proper access to resources regarding decolonizing education, and is there a gap in kind of professional development and available resources?
I would say we're narrowing a gap. There is a gap, of course. So I would now argue that one of the hardest gaps or pieces is twofold. One, it's time, because it takes a commitment to learn and to better your knowledge base, and that time is valuable. And it's, how do you, you know, when these courses are offered, there's a couple of things that can happen. You're either taken away from your class, which is a hardship, right? You like being with your class for good things, but it's, you're away and you have to prep and you have to do those things. Or it's over summer break, where the teaching is exhausting and people need that ability to disconnect. So I don't know, is it, we have 10 days during the school year, right, that we are afforded to learn things, perhaps, but then it's piecemeal, it's one off, right? Time, I find, is an interesting, like, challenge to work with. And then, to be frank, it's in part, it's interest / the teacher that, I don't want to get this wrong, so I'm not going to do anything. And that, to me, to do nothing or to not learn, that's absolutely opposite of what you are as an educator. And nothing has been done. We've seen the, you know, what comes of that. You got to go learn right now. And because you're of this place and from this place, it behooves you to find time. And even if you're doing something initially and you get it wrong, own it. Like, own your mistake and seek to do better.
How have student groups, student activism, and extracurricular activities played a role in decolonizing education?
Huge. Because those questions that may not be attended to because of whatever curricular constraint or for whatever reason, you can ask questions that are provocative or provoking more easily, I guess, if you will, and have the students that are there in the first place for a purpose, and then the mindset is really, really engaged to discuss heavy topics or heavy pieces. And that's not that they're going to solve things, but that they think about them, and that's important. I had opportunity, and I'm gonna get a little emotional here, but I had opportunity. Our John Pritchard School has a beautiful welcoming space, and that's going to act in part as a classroom. It's kind of too near the highway to be a proper classroom, but it's a far vastly different look than when I taught there years ago. So that is, it used to be just this kind of ill-kempt, we shouldn't say that, it was grass and just didn't have purpose. So they put in a sacred circle, and they put in some rocks. And so this past year, when we opened our school, we opened with a sort of a smudge of that circle. And I wore my ribbon skirt. And I think this was one of the first times a leader, teacher, wore a ribbon skirt, because the elementary students, it's a K-8, that came up to me afterwards and touching my skirt, right? And I have a ribbon skirt. I have a ribbon skirt. I have a ribbon shirt. Do you know what that is? Yes, I know that. And so next time maybe we'll wear it together, you know? And so part of this was from our Indigenous leaders, like student leadership, who wanted to bring that about. We had a beading at school, a young man who beads, his name's Will and William, and his mom taught him, and he led, I don't know, I think it was like 30, 32 kids. It was too much. Anyways, but he was amazing. He was just a little, and he's going around, he's fixing things, and I'm stabbing my fingers because I don't, but he's being like a teacher, and he goes, this teaching is hard. Yeah, well, you can, appreciate that. But he was so admired, and so, people needing him, and for such good purpose. We have a smudge club that's going to be reignited. It was apparently a few years ago, but then COVID, because, COVID. So we're reigniting a few pieces. I would love to bring, with our music teacher, our elementary music teacher, a drum club. And so we've got drums. He's getting bear grease to make sure to do things right, to teach the kids about doing those pieces. And those kids can be part of either a drumming group, an Indigenous group. Like, we can use it in so many capacities. Theater allows so much, right? Theater, to me, is the great equalizer. It you can give me any student, and we can work. There's a role. There's a job. It is purposeful. You are needed. And we can go to your passion. Be it sound, be it staging, be it wardrobe, be it the actual acting, be it the crafting of a play, and bringing together stories, go theater kids. So those clubs can bring about different ways of acknowledging, teaching, learning. All kinds of different elements that can come together.
Can you talk about the Indigenous Academic Achievement Program and your role in that?
Yeah, that was, I love that group. They set up for the first Orange Shirt Day. They set that all in motion. First as a small group, right? Right within our sort of thing. And then other kids would pass by. What's that smell? Smudge. Are you sure? Yes. Listen, there's different, but even in that ignorant statement of are you sure? The kids taught, right? No, it is. Here, come here. And I was like, and then another kid would come, and they would stay, and they would learn, right? And then they might not come the next time, but they'll come three times, and then they'll come again. and bringing kids together. And so, again, like my teaching, early teaching, initially it was me trying to bring people together. But after a while, you can just let go. And if you, it's, I don't know if you remember this, Hannah, but it was the same as when I was teaching theater, right? For if I had you from grade 9 to grade 12, by grade 12, I shouldn't be in the theater. You are doing this. I'm outside if you need, if like disaster happens, but it's not going to. And otherwise, you're doing this because that's what I'm teaching. It's just you. The Indigenous groups were the same. What do you want? What do you want to know? First, you got to be provoked by the question, or you know, agitated a little bit. Like, did you know this was happening? No. Well, what are we going to do about it? You know, kind of thing. That's actually the financial literacy award I won was based off that very, very concept of having the kids come together, and they were complaining that, you know, they're broke. Oh, me too. Okay, what are we going to do? You know, like, what do you want to do about it? And then within that, threading and supporting them with things like, you know, Keynesian economics, and but not using scary words, right? Using this is how we can make money. This is, and then if you want to keep it through an Indigenous perspective, we're also going to be giving away things. That's what we do, you know, sort of thing. That's part of that, right? That sharing piece. And having kids decide, and children decide, students decide what they want to do. And then it's a little crazy making for me in a sense, in that I have to go and learn about Keynesian economics because like I have an idea, right? But if I'm going to be working with them, I need to make sure that what I'm also doing is correct, as correct as I can be, and being very transparent of if I don't know something, I don't know something, you go learn it, tell me what it is, right? Like, and so that respect of what they can do and expectation that they are going to do it and that we're going to do it well. And if we fumble, we fumble. Like, you know, failure is absolutely magnificent. How do you learn if you don't fail? Like, it's you got to fail, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about academic achievement. So, interestingly, the more we failed, the better we got. you know, and then all of a sudden, again, Murdoch won so many Maya Awards, so many Manitoba Indigenous Youth Academic Achievement, or not academic, Achievement Awards, in such a variety of things, right? So yeah, so that group ended up doing, like they raised over, I think it was, you know, I'm not going to say a number, but it was a huge number for a small group of kids for the Point Douglas Women's Center, right? And which was really dearly needed at, you know, post-Christmas when funds dry up and things like that. And so they had purpose, they had power, they had choice. They were learning stuff they didn't even know they were learning, and it was good. So yeah, they're a good group of kids.
Yeah. So to wrap up, now that you've transitioned from teaching or classroom teaching into an administrative role as VP at John Pritchard, how do you think administrators can and should work to decolonize education?
Good question. I think ultimately you work on yourself first, because if you are like a leader, you should know why you are doing those pieces or why you're leading, right? You need to know, you need to me, be very reflective, self-reflective on your practice. I mean, like, on the daily. And I'd hope that in leadership, someone who chooses that, you will intuitively or just it's just part of what you do, right? To do that, you work on yourself first. You try to recognize that you don't know everything. You humble with humility. You go to those who know more because they know more, you know, something. And you actively seek those pieces. So when you work on yourself, then to me, just organically, it works. You're working with others. You're gonna A, role model, and B, support as people are questioning things, or again, like one of the conversations of I don't want to do it wrong happened this year in 2024 with me with another educator. I don't want to do it wrong. Okay, that's good, but to freeze and do nothing is to me more than wrong. It's you need to, we need to work together. How can I support you? So I had opportunity to bring in for my educational assistants a blanket exercise. So they're going, we're going to do it again. Like, this isn't a one-off thing. It's not a checkbox. Like, so my educational assistants are working with that. They have some had more, but everybody has a flake of understanding, a flake and being on the same page. We're going to do it again this coming year with the teachers. And now our educational assistants, for me, they should know a little bit to support their teachers, right? To work with them. And some of the teachers have done this before. So everybody needs to start working together to build that collective again, build that individual capacity and collective capacity of, in this case, the blanket exercise. And I get to make those decisions about what we get to learn together. Of course, with input, of course. And not assumption that maybe the blanket exercise has been done, 14 times. I know it hasn't, right? So that's why I'm bringing it, sort of thing. But I get to make those pieces. So happen for people. And then I myself, because I've done this so long, again, that age thing is a beautiful thing. I have contacts. You need someone. Let me see if they are available. Do you want to talk to someone? Let me see if this works. Do you want this programming? This I think it was at the University of Alberta. Somebody was giving away like free education, high level education about First Nations. Did you know that happened? Like, you go and learn, right? It's a podcast while you're doing dishes in the morning. Find the time and the self.
Well, thank you, Kim, for joining me today for the second episode of the History in the Hot Seat, the Teaching and Knowing of Canada's Past podcast. And thank you to everyone for listening. Follow the Center for Human Rights Research on social media through the links in the description to stay informed about future History in the Hot Seat podcast episodes. The History in the Hot Seat, the Teaching and Knowing of Canada's Past project and podcast are made possible by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council's Knowledge Synthesis Grant and the support of the Center for Human Rights Research, the University of Manitoba, the Winnipeg School Division, and UMFM.